You ready? Job, the book of. Well, we've come to it. Tonight we begin the 42 chapter, 34 week study through the book of Job. Having spent personally the last few months studying Job myself, I must say I'm very excited to begin working through every word of it with you. Speaking of this book, the Victorian author, some of you may know, Thomas Carlyle, said this of Job. Job is the grandest book ever written with pen. In the introduction to Job in the recently published Systematic Theology Study Bible, you'll find this description. Job is a literary and theological masterpiece. It combines surprising narratives and heated conversations that test the mettle of its main characters. The book's goal is wisdom, which here and other Old Testament books amount to balanced living based on a proper understanding of God and people. And lastly, in the introduction of Job, in the recently also published Spurgeon Study Bible, you'll find this paragraph. The book of Job teaches that suffering comes to everyone, the righteous and unrighteous alike. God does not always keep the righteous from danger or suffering. Ultimately, though, God controls all of life's situations, including limiting the power of Satan. God's comfort and strength are always available to the trusting soul. Now, before we actually get into our text this evening, which is chapter 1, verse 1 to 5, that's all we're covering tonight, there are two preliminary statements that need to be said about the book of Job in general. And you'll find them all right here in our trusty chalkboard, donated to us generously by Andrew. So, a long time ago, we've been using it for a while. So, first, Job is long. It's kind of a duh statement. Second, Job is poetry. First, Job is long, 42 chapters to be exact. And while most people are very familiar with the beginning and very familiar with the ending, most people have no idea what to do with the middle. The muddled middle where they're arguing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So let's ask a question at the start. Why is Job so long? Why is Job so long? Perhaps the answer, I'm sure there's many reasons for this, but perhaps one of the answers is that God intends to take us on a journey. A journey that will take some time. A journey that God intends to make us into a different person. How? By entering into, becoming familiar with, being unsettled by the suffering of Job. And learning that when suffering is in view, there is no easy answer. There is no quick fix. And so rightly handled, the book of Job cannot be distilled into two sermons on the front end, one sermon for the middle chunk, and one sermon for the end, with loose application given afterwards. You must enter into it, sit down and get cozy as much as you can into it, and listen carefully. Because not only Job's suffering is in view, Christ's suffering is in view. Job's suffering is extreme. And to put it bluntly, none of you have suffered like Job has. Job's suffering is extreme. It is very rare. And it exists in the scripture to point us to the truly innocent sufferer that would one day come. And so without Christ's suffering coming into view, one commentator said, Job is only a record of unanswered agony. So Job is long. And God intends it to be such, and God has something for us of patience in this, to sit through this. Second, Job is poetry. Job is poetry. Other than chapter 1, 2, and 42, the entirety of the other chapters of Job are poetic, and we must remember that. Poetry always has a personal take on something, aiming not just at our heads, at the accumulation or the transmission of knowledge, but at the heart. What gets behind these things? Because of this, on one hand, poetry is well suited to speak to the needs of the whole soul. Similar to the Psalms, John Calvin would say that the Psalms contain all the anatomy of the soul. We'll find all the anatomy of the soul within Job as well. Poetry, on the other hand, does not often sum up things into neat and tidy categories. It doesn't bring them into clearly defined sections. Rather, it tends to slowly work on us the further that we linger in it. And any of you that have read poetry, you know this. The first meaning is not the second meaning, is not the third, the fourth, the 18th, the 492nd meaning. The longer you sit in it, the more of its layers tend to unravel. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Christopher Ashe, on this point, makes a comment. He says, "You cannot do Job as a tourist might do Florence. You can't just do it. You have to sit in it." So as you can imagine, because of this book's nature, the contents of it, the popularity of it, there have been many commentaries, books, sermons, and songs written about these 42 chapters. And a glaring omission in most of the content produced historically in Job is seeing Christ in Job, rather than just getting a doctrine of suffering, getting a doctrine of Christ from Job, from all the scriptures. To see this, I have chosen one commentary to guide our discussion for these 42 chapters. His name is Christopher Ashe. You've heard me quote him. You've already heard some of his stuff here in the introduction. His commentary, Job, in the Preaching the Word commentary series, is a wonderfully insightful commentary and a very readable commentary. And if I could suggest it, this is what I've been doing the past few months. I'm still doing it now. I'm reading it for my devotions, one chapter at a time. And it's been very, very encouraging for me. And so I commend that to you. You'll find it worth your time. So, without further ado, let's begin. If I were to ask you, what kind of world would you like to live in? How would you answer? What kind of world would you like to live in? We'd eventually, if we talked about this, all come around to similar answers. I think we'd like to live in a world that isn't fallen. That's what most of us would say. We'd like to live in a world where the wicked don't prosper and the good, or the seemingly good, there is none good, Romans 3, the good are not trampled on. Our friends across the pond in the UK have a saying to describe a gathering of really important celebrities or political people. They say, when talking about that gathering, they say the great and the good were there. And everybody knows over there what they mean. And I think when we answer the question, what kind of world would we like to live in, we'd all eventually get around to that, where those that were great were also good. And that those leading were not always the most wicked people on the planet, or the most selfish people on the planet. Where great men and women leading our world do govern justly and humbly. If that were the case, it would be a well-run world. This is the world of Job chapter 1, verse 1 to 5. It's a well-ordered world, a well-run planet. Listen to these first five verses. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and a very many servants. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. So everything that we read in the book of Job, it should not be a surprise here, is about Job. It's his name that we learn first. It's his uprightness, his holiness, his suffering that's in view throughout the whole book. And in 99% of the book of Job, either Job is talking, Job's friends are talking about Job, or God is talking to Job or about Job, or the friends about how they were talking to Job. And so this book is about Job. And in the first 5 verses, we learn 4 prominent things about this man: his place, his godliness, his greatness, and his anxiety. That's where we're headed. His place, first. Job lived in the land of Uz. We don't know much of Uz in Scripture. We read of it in a few other places, specifically Lamentations 4:21, which says this: "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom." So most people think Uz was in Edom. They were Edomites. "You who dwell in the land of Uz." So from all we can gather, it seems that Uz was a city in Edom, which was a pagan land east of the promised land. Notice here, not mainly where Uz is, but where Uz is not. It isn't in Israel. And in fact, Job's story never really comes into anything that has to do with Israel at all. This is probably because it was written before there was a nation of Israel. Most people think that Job existed and was contemporaries with the patriarchs, especially the first of them, Abraham. So right in that Genesis 9 to 11 to 12 time, we can stick Job right in there. And it is thought that this is the first of all the books to ever be written in Scripture. And so it's a very, very early book. God's people had not been created. They were not enslaved in Egypt yet. They were not given his law. And he hadn't brought them into the promised land yet. But before all these things, here is a man named Job who should have known nothing about God. But we find that he knows God and he lives a life that wants to honor God and, in a sense, spread God through his household and uprightness. So that's his place. Let's look now at his godliness. Of all the things that we hear in verse 1 to 5, we hear the most important thing is his godliness. It says it in verse 1, "Job was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil." This same word, blameless, shows up all throughout the rest of the Old Testament. In Joshua 24:14, it is translated as sincerity. In Judges 9:16, it's translated as integrity. God calls Abraham in Genesis 17:1 to walk before him blamelessly. And in Psalm 119, verse 1, the psalmist says, "Blessing will come to those whose way is blameless." And so when we look at Job, we should be honestly refreshed to a large degree, because Job, as opposed to so many of us, what you see is really what you get. You see godliness on the outside because it really is there on the inside. This is the man that's being portrayed to us here in these first five verses. The opposite of this is hypocrisy, pretending outwardly to be something that we're not inwardly. Now think about this. Centuries later, Paul had counseled Timothy in 2 Timothy 3:5, saying, "This is how you pastor those who have the appearance of godliness but deny its power." Job is refreshing because he not only has the appearance of godliness, but he lives according to its power. So he is a real godly man. It says he feared God and turned away from evil, meaning vertically he had a true love and devotion for God, which impacted his horizontal experience with all those that he related to. So within the land of Uz, if there was one man that you could do business with that you would not be defrauded by, it would be Job. He's an upright man whom you can trust, and someone that you would go to for counsel, someone with true piety. And he's certainly, as we look at him, an exemplary model for Christian living in all ages. We have to pause here and say, this is something we need to remember about Job. This is something we need to remember about Job. What do we need to remember about Job? His godliness. Why? Because the whole time his friends speak to him, they do not believe this. They do not believe that he is a godly man. And though they often will find, frustratingly so, speak things that are true about the universe, about God, and about how he deals with us, they apply all of those truths wrongly to Job. Because they believe that Job, somewhere deep inside, is hiding some kind of secret sin, and this is why all this suffering has taken place in his life. And the longer that we listen to these friends, the more we'll be tempted to forget these first five verses. What they say of him is not true. What he says of himself, as arrogant as it may come across at times, is true. He is an innocent man. He had no secret sins that he was ashamed about. He is suffering innocently, yet redemptively, yet his friends had no category for this in their well-ordered world. So we have to remember this about Job, which then leads us to the next item about Job, his greatness. In verse 2 and 3, we learn that Job has a lot of stuff. If you've moved recently, or if you've ever moved, to think in the first 7 years Holly and I were married, we moved once every year. And I don't know why, we just did. And looking back, we're not sure why we did, but every time it was incredibly frustrating getting all our stuff somewhere else. Well, think about, after reading his stuff, the catalog of everything he has, how much would that be to move? It'd be ridiculous. So let's look at his family, and let's look at his possessions. In verse 2 and 3, we learn he has 7 sons, 3 daughters, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, 500 female donkeys, and many, it doesn't even give a number, servants. And so from this, there is only one conclusion that we can appropriately arrive at. He was the greatest man of all the East, which means Uz was in the East. No one greater than Job. Try to picture this. I know it may be difficult, but try to picture somebody with as much as Donald Trump, with as much godliness as Job. And this is what you have. It's a modern day comparison, despite the character unparalleled there. So that's what's that. So his family, seven sons, was seen in this culture as something of a goal to attain. If you recall, at the end of Ruth chapter 4, Naomi's friends who see her holding young Obed, they say that Ruth was to Naomi, she is more to you than seven sons. When the formerly barren Hannah, finally, her womb is opened, she says this in 1 Samuel 2:15, praising God, "The barren has borne seven." And so the number seven in this culture symbolizes a completeness, a wholeness. And not only were seven a complete number, but seven sons were even more beneficial, because sons in an agrarian community meant that you could do a lot of work. They were the ones that would take over the household. They were the ones that would do the majority of the work as the patriarch of the family grows older and older. And so it would also be a promise of an extended family lineage. And so we then should ask the question, what more could you want than seven sons? Well, the author says, how about three daughters? There's more than seven sons. There's three daughters, which is also itself is a number of completion, which taking seven sons and three daughters, we get the truth that Job's quiver, to use such language, is full. He has many arrows in his quiver. And in addition to his children, he has an enormous amount of possessions. When you combine all his animals and servants that manage his entire estate, we come to see that Job is a man of not only great wealth, but great power, great authority, great wielding within the land of Uz. And so we understand that he was so great and so powerful that there was no one like this in all the East. And so it's interesting here, so often in Scripture, right, especially in the Gospels, here in Job, what we have in view is God coming to interact, and Jesus does this in the Gospels many times, with people with large reputations. A lot of the people that Jesus interacted with had horrible reputations, but they were large. Job, during his time and in his place, there is no one with a larger reputation. Which means what God does through him will megaphone, not only in that context, but it's no surprise that we are still reading of Job today. It itself is evidence that there was no one greater during his time. On this point, Christopher Ashe, the commentary that I commended to you, he says of Job, "Job was on a regional scale what Adam was intended to be on a global scale. Great, rich, and powerful ruler." So we conclude this third point. We see that Job was enormously blessed by God, immensely faithful. Enormously blessed, immensely faithful. Is anybody hearing some language that you normally get on Christian TV? Prosperity gospel. It actually works in a well-run world. Those who are the godliest have the most stuff. Now, there's all sorts of issues with this problem. It's in the Old Testament context. It's not moving into the New Covenant context. But we'll see that even in this, what seems to be the perfect environment, there's something about Job that should give us a bit of a chill or a shiver. His anxiety. In verse 4 and 5, we see that each time his sons and his daughters got together for what seems to be perhaps a birthday. Notice there in verse 5, I get birthday because verse 4, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house. When? Of each one on his day. And so it seems that the 10 children got into a habit, which would have been fun to do. You should do this with your siblings. On their day, you go and throw them a party. And so this seems to be the pattern that Job's children did. But after these events, Job himself grew very anxious. So he would call each of them to his house one by one for a ceremony. Rising early in the morning, he would prepare a burnt offering for each one of them. And we know, looking down into the rest of redemptive history as the old covenant context comes into clearer and clearer view, that the burnt offering is something that God commanded to his people once he brought them out of slavery in Egypt and sent them into the promised land. And this burnt offering was the most expensive of offerings that God commanded for them, where a whole animal was burned up in the fire. And this meant to be similar to what we saw this morning, for those of you who are here, to the eye, what they heard with the ear. They saw the fire on the mountain. They heard the thunder. They felt the quaking and the shaking. And then God gave them a law and a burnt offering where they could see with their eyes fiery wrath consuming what was symbolizing sin. And so, the fire symbolized God's anger toward sin. The animal symbolizes the sinner, and that the fire would then consume the animal in its entirety symbolized what God would do to sinners unless they were redeemed. And so you can get a bit of a picture, as Job did this for each one of his children, all 10, that this was not a quick event, that he'd call the first one and say, "This is for you." Light the match, and they'd wait for that one to be consumed. He'd call the second one and say, "This is for you." And he'd do the same. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. With all of them. This was not a quick event. He was anxious. And we think, why was he anxious? Why go to all the trouble and expense to do this after 10 birthday parties a year, and maybe even more festivities that they had just culturally? Why go to all this expense? We learn in verse 5, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." I'm sure some of you who are in the realm of psychology and dealing with parents and children, you're aware of some modern sensibilities toward this type of environment that children would be brought up in. And they'd probably say, how unhealthy would it be for a parent to continually, every time they have a festivity, continually every time say, "Did you curse God? We have to do an offering just in case." And so the children grows up underneath the weight of what would happen if they cursed God. And yet, even though this is anxiety for Job, maybe, perhaps they did this. This isn't reality. This is a maybe. But this is a father leading his family in family worship. True, the worship was probably a bit more intense than we're used to. I mean, we don't do this on Sunday mornings. Peter would have a fit. Thus, Job did continually. So, we've seen that Job is long, that Job is poetic. We've seen his place, his godliness, his greatness, his anxiety. And the stage is set. Into this well-ordered world, we meet the great man, Job. Some commentators, you should know, try to go into all sorts of fancy explanations about what Job's name means. The commentary that we're using, or that I'm using to guide this series, he says Job's name is just Job. It doesn't mean anything in particular because it's not there. We can't quite press into these things. And so I would encourage you not to do so either. In verse 1 and 3, we see the man himself, and in verse 4 and 5, we see the man's continual actions. This sets up a happy scene with one large shadow. The happiness consists in a good man being good, and a pious man being a prosperous man. It's a picture of the world being as the world ought to be, where those that are the greatest in society are the most godly in the society. It's, ironically, a world where the prosperity gospel seems to be true. The shadow is that even in this seemingly perfect scene, something dark looms beneath the surface. Job is anxious about it after every family festivity. And even in this perfect setting, we learn two great truths. First, in the best and most materially abundant societies, families, settings, the possibility still exists for men and women to curse God. And second, only sacrifice, bloody, atoning, gory, wrathful, substitutionary sacrifice, only that kind of sacrifice can cover such sin. That's the world of Job 1:1-5. And previewing, Lord willing, next Sunday evening, verse 6 all the way to chapter 2, verse 10, we get a window into another world, the world that runs this world. And in that world, we see all sorts of wonderful things that we'll, I'm sure, have a million questions about.